Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor to speak at the 50th anniversary. One of the things of which I'm most proud is that I've been a member of this society for 40 years. Mr. Beaulieu thought he would have trouble being optimistic in speaking about economics. At least he didn't have the subject of culture. Well, in a troubled culture, one loses the distinctions between the human and the divine and the human and the non-human, providing all kinds of curious behavior. So what I'm going to do is begin by giving you several vignettes from contemporary times, which will provide, I think, some flavor, and then later turn to some more serious reflections. I have a favorite line from the book Axel's Castle, based on a 19th century French play, in which the hero says, "As for living, our servants will do that for us." This seems to have gone to an extreme in the United States in the realm of pet care. There are organizations that will take care of your pets when you're too busy to do so. And one, for instance, flew a dog to spend the summer with his family in Colorado. But even better, and I'm quoting from the article about this from the Washington Post, other helpers changed the TV channel at one client's house. Her beagle liked the Animal Planet Network, but the client didn't want the dog watching its more troubling animal rescue shows. Depriving one's pet of the spiritual purgation that Aristotle said great Dhamma could provide is a sign of the superficiality of our times. One could perhaps understand the client not wishing the beagle to watch a show in which the animal doesn't get rescued. But what is wrong with the effect of a good drama in which the animal is rescued? I think the beagle would be a better dog for it. The more troubling the predicament, the greater the catharsis, as Aristotle told us in the Poetics. However, Aristotle was addressing humans, and as one, I may be out of my depth here. Also, instead of pets, I have children, and they don't watch TV at all. In fact, the other night at home, my youngest daughter, Teresa, who's only 9, that's how I simulate being a grandfather, popped up and said, "I tell my friends at school, life is better without a TV." And I said, "Well, Teresa, how would you know that life is better without a TV? You've never had a TV." She said, "Oh, no, I've seen it at my friend's house, and it rots your brain." Yes, girl. However, my children have seen a number of people rescue movies and seem spiritually refreshed by them. In fact, they even like animal rescue movies. So perhaps the beagle could nudge into this genre by trying a people rescue movie, and if not too distressed, move on to Animal Planet. Now, animals were also in the news in a less favorable light, occasioned by the resignation of a former ambassador from the State Department, made before recent changes by President Obama. According to the Washington Post, he resigned, quote, in order to protest the rules and regulations that he believes are unfair to the same-sex partners of Foreign Service officers, giving them fewer benefits than family pets, unquote. There is an unfortunate insinuation here that leaves one in doubt as to exactly where Ambassador Guest stands in respect to the rights of these pets. There is an unfortunate insinuation here that leaves one in doubt as to exactly where he stands in respect to these pets. Could this be because the great majority of family pets are heterosexual? Well, on to the more mordant side. The Chicago Tribune has reported that the Dignitas group in Switzerland is having a hard time holding leases because neighboring tenants complain about the body bags carried out of its office. Dignitas supports assisted suicide. Apparently, countries like Belgium and the Netherlands, which allow this curious ritual, require its beneficiaries to be citizens, a dubious right of sovereignty that must have escaped the American founders. Though who knows, Justice Anthony Kennedy at any moment might discover it in an emanation from a penumbra of the Bill of Rights, just as he did the right to sodomy and homosexual marriage. But broad-minded Switzerland allows foreign visitors to partake in assisted suicide, earning it the appellation the capital of death tourism. Since 1998, the appeal of See Switzerland and Die has attracted more than 800 temporary visitors, all of whom promise not to overstay the terms of their visas. However, the regular sight of body bags upset neighbors like Margot Heyer, who said, "Well, you see people arrive, you know in a few hours they will be dead. I found myself constantly thinking of death," unquote. So I have suggested to Dignitas they could solve this problem by providing graveside services, thus relieving the housing problem and the Swiss of their dreadful thoughts of death. But maybe more cheerfully, let's get to the beginnings, or the maybe beginnings of life, not its end. I don't know if Dan is with us this morning, but I quote the Wall Street Journal in his honor here because it reported that some single women are choosing to freeze their eggs rather than procreate now. It's called oocyte cryopreservation, and it costs from $9,000 to $14,000. The journal reported that one customer, quote, keeps a laboratory photo of her eggs, which she calls her maybe babies, tacked to her home office bulletin board, unquote. Each maybe birthday, the eggs look exactly the same. Thanks to refrigerated fertility, they achieve a kind of maybe immortality. Unless maybe mom gets involved in cryogenics for herself, however, the march of time may deprive her of her maybe single parenthood. Another maybe mom, who thinks the procedure eases the pressure from family members to have children, asks, "What's the alternative?" You'd think after 50 years of the sexual revolution that something would suggest itself to her. But no, no. Let's go on to some of the spiritual aspects of the modern world in America. And here we have some good news. A Parade magazine poll on spirituality reported that 69% of Americans believe in God. However, this is very interesting. They also reported that 77% of Americans pray outside of religious services. I wonder about that extra 8% who apparently do not believe in God but pray anyway outside somewhere. What exactly do they think they're doing? Is this some kind of insurance policy? Perhaps it's the spiritual equivalent of President Obama's health care plan. It's something you believe in that's not really there. More intriguing yet are the results of the survey by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. The survey discovered that 25% of its respondents believe in reincarnation. That number only drops to 22% among Christians. for whom the resurrection should be a particularly interesting event. Will they be coming or going? I was given some sound advice some years ago, which I pass on to you, which is do not fly in airlines whose pilots believe in reincarnation. Now, I love modern art and architecture because of the lengths to which people will go to convince themselves that it's wonderful. Occasionally, the cat gets out of the bag, and it did again in another Wall Street Journal piece, reporting that a Chicago architect, Bruce Graham, once asked the famous German architect, Mies van der Rohe, why he did not live in his famous glass and steel apartment building on 860 Lakeshore Drive, right up the street here. You could walk up to 860 and look at this iconic building that Mies van der Rohe built. Mies responded, quote, there's no place to put the furniture. I was born in a little village in Germany. I can dream and imagine this new world, but I can't live in it, unquote. Now, my old professor, Harry Jaffa, said, quote, the telos of any building is the purpose of the life to be lived within it, and how that life contributes to the larger purpose of life, unquote. Well, in fact, I had a friend who lived in it at 860 Lakeshore Drive. He became an alcoholic. A sociologist would tell you that's only a correlation, not necessarily a cause. But I spent the night there once and joined him in some adult beverages to warn off the chilling sterility of the place. If the furniture can't fit, how are the people supposed to, you know? Now, on to the pictorial arts. I recall some years ago taking my children to the National Gallery of Art, the new wing, to see an exhibit. And we had to pass by the new American art, in which there was a room at the end of which was a massive painting, almost the size of half of the front wall, labeled abstraction number 32, that looked like the leavings of some kind of volcanic eruption. It was very hard to tell. Russell Kirk pointed out many years ago, I think very aptly, that abstract art isn't abstract because it's not an abstraction of anything. It's just a mess. So I had my little daughter, Catherine, not Teresa, Catherine was holding my hand rather apprehensively as she looked at it, and she said, Daddy, is it a monster? And I thought for a moment and said, yes, Catherine, it is a monster. Well, this is another story about an exhibit, a more recent exhibit at the National Gallery of Art, and the reaction to it in the Sunday art section from the Washington Post by their critic. It was celebrating an exhibit of Mark Rothko's seven huge canvases of various shades of black in the gallery's East Building. Now, oddly enough, the critic, Blake Gopnik, found them flesh-colored. Only later in the piece did I understand why. These works, Gopnik tells us, quote, allow us to look more closely than ever at the shift toward the lightless and color-free in Rothko's work. I have to admit that this is not a progression that holds me breathless. Black, blacker, blackest. Gopnik expressed annoyance at those possessed of trite ideas who insist that, quote, blackness must always come saddled with the weightiest of connotations. It's never just a tone It's always a kind of placeholder for something else, bigger and deeper and more profound than itself. Can you see where this is going? But then Gopnik has an epiphany. He realizes, quote, an almost moral imperative to go beyond our clichés about what blackness means, unquote. Well, how does he achieve this? Well, it happens that there were two African-American security guards dressed in black uniforms in the room with the Rothkos. Quote, Gopnik says, and it suddenly seemed wrong to reduce the complex color of their skin to a single formulaic reading. These guards, happily protecting the works under their care, certainly didn't stand for existential angst or for a depressed mood, unquote. Well, there you go. If you find Rothko depressing, you're probably a racist who finds African Americans depressing. You have reduced them both to the same dark meaning. If you could only realize what Gopnik calls the tremendous joie de vivre in these works, you could see how happy the African American guards are as well. Well, I was so inspired by Gopnik's article that I made a pilgrimage to the Rothko exhibit to see the happy guards for myself. Only one was on duty during my visit, but I was able to ask her what she thought of the paintings. She replied, "He's weird." "He got depressed." Indeed, though the brochure with the exhibit failed to mention, Rothko committed suicide, apparently unable to see the lighter side of the darkness. Well, I asked her, what about the background music that was playing, titled Rothko Chapel, commissioned by minimalist composer Morton Feldman? "It puts me to sleep," she answered. I then asked her, "Have you considered a career in art criticism?" How much time? I have 1 minute? Well, we won't get to the serious part of the talk then. Though I will just very quickly and do so in the words of a real art critic, Roger Scruton. In fact, I encourage you to go to YouTube and watch Roger's program, Why Beauty Matters. He says of modern art, such as Serrano's Piss Christ, that, quote, willful desecration is also a denial of love, an attempt to remake the world as if love were no longer a part of it. I think this is one of the single most profound sentences on the art of modernity that I have encountered. It effectively exposes the spiritual viciousness at the heart of much modern art. Thus, we are left with a loveless culture, which is, according to Roger, quote, determined to portray the world as unlovable. This art does not show reality, but takes revenge on it. He adds that a fake work of art shares in the ugliness it shows, and that it is immoral because it attempts to obliterate meaning from the human form. I'm just, if you will indulge me for a moment, you know, as what is the answer to this? How do we go ahead and get out of this? Well, my friends, it's as Dostoevsky said, beauty will save the world. Is beauty salvific? What could he have meant by that? I'm going to give you an instance from someone whom everyone in this society respects and who is a hero to us all, and that is Whittaker Chambers, a great, great writer. And here is a section from Witness that reports on what I think is the primordial experience of beauty that each of us at some time in our lives has experienced and the direction in which it points us so that we can understand what Dostoevsky meant. Here is Chambers talking about himself as a young boy. Quote, "One day I wandered off alone and found myself before a high hedge that I'd never seen before. It was so tall that I could not see over it and so thick that I could not see through it. But by lying flat on the ground, I wriggled between the provit stems. I stood up on the other side in a field covered from end to end as high as my head, with thistles in full bloom. Clinging to the purple flowers, hovering over them, or twittering and dipping in flight, were dozens of goldfinches, little gold yellow birds with black contrasting wings and caps. They did not pay the slightest attention to me, as if they had never seen a boy before. The sight was unexpected. The beauty was so absolute that I thought I could not stand it and held to the hedge for support. Out loud, I said, 'God.' It was a simple statement, not an exclamation, of which I would then have been incapable. At that moment, which I remembered through all the years of my life as one of its highest moments, I was closer than I would be again for almost 40 years to the intuition that alone could give meaning to my life, the intuition that God and beauty are one. I suggest to you that the hieratic purpose of art is to make the transcendent perceptible, to recapture through its means this experience that Chambers underwent. The transcendent is infinite, and we are finite. And the attempt to make it perceptible contains that tremendous drama in the enterprise that so fascinates it when we see it. And at the end of which we can have something like this, and then I promise to sit down. You were kind enough to mention Surprised by Beauty. The new edition of this book is twice as long. It's 200,000 words. It contains all good news about contemporary composers and music. One such composer just recently died in England, John Tavener, but he tells you what it is about music that can bring you to the Whittaker Chambers moment in his artistic credo, which says, quote, "My goal is to recover one simple memory from which all art derives, the constant memory of the paradise from which we have fallen, leads to the paradise which was promised to the repentant thief. The gentleness of our sleepy recollections promises something else. That which was once perceived as in a glass darkly, we shall see face to face. We shall not only see it, we shall hear it. And in fact, you can hear it now. Thank you."